Okay, so when you're comfortable, I will begin this talk. And anyone who's late, that's their fault. The old saying is, the early bird catches the worm, which is not really a good Buddhist simile, is it? But then when you think about it, if the worm hadn't got up so early, it wouldn't have got caught. So it is the worm's fault. Or perhaps the worm hadn't got up early. Perhaps the worm hadn't gone to bed yet, was out all night, in which case it deserved to get caught. But anyway, this morning, last night, somebody asked a question about mindfulness, and it is one of the most misunderstood ideas in meditation. It was emphasized by especially the Burmese Vipassana tradition. Out of all proportion to what you read in the suttas, it is important, but it's also not really understood all that well. And that causes a lot of confusion for meditators. So, this morning, I'm going to talk about mindfulness, what it is, and more importantly, how it is developed. Because I think you've all heard by now that all this effort and control is, as far as Ajahn Brahm is concerned, is enemy number one. That is the bad guy. And so a lot of times people try to be mindful with effort and control. And that is actually quite dangerous. And so I wanted to point that out to people. And to point out the other way which mindfulness is generated, and just how that fits in to the rest of the Eightfold Path and creates a very, very strong, happy mind which becomes still and gains incredibly powerful insights. So this is a talk on mindfulness. But to begin with, when mindfulness is separated from all the other factors of the Eightfold Path, as if it's the path and the only path and all by itself, you get a very, very strange situation, which was first pointed out to me in a way which I could explain to others. I knew what was wrong, but it was a very good anecdote which makes it very, very clear what is happening. But I went to one of these conferences once over in Sydney, and it was about meditation and happiness conference, organized by the Vajrayanas over in Sydney. And they've got a lot of funds to use, and they obviously charge the earth for people to come and listen to the conference so they could afford all these people, including the very, very expensive teachers like myself. I always go for free. But there was one of the presenters was a professor from Stanford University. You know, so that's one of the top universities. Not quite as good as Cambridge. You know, nothing as good as Cambridge, but you know, it's almost there. But in these universities today, mindfulness, especially in the United States, has got such a huge reputation of being used in all sorts of different areas, not just for Buddhism and becoming enlightened, but for healing so many other of the modern psychological ailments which we have. So these days, you ask any psychologist and they say, oh, we do MBCT, which means mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. It's just a buzzword. So this was one of those professors who was given a lot of money by Stanford University to do more research into mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And when you got lots of money like that, you could do some very, very neat experiments. And the experiment he taught us about was one which they did at Stanford. They used the psychology students in 1 year. And you know, if they agree to participate in these experiments, they get credits. It's like, you know, passing the exam or putting in assignments. So they all volunteered, especially when they heard what the experiment was. Because at random, they would split this group of people, students, into two groups. one of those groups would go to a mindfulness retreat for one day. And the other group was sent to a California spa for one day. Now, I think you all know what a mindfulness retreat is. You may even know what a California spa is. You know, hot baths. I've seen just on the in-flight magazines, on the aircraft, where I get lots of my information about life. They have these hot stones and they pour oil over you and they massage you and all these amazing things. And people spend a lot of money going to these spas. And of course, this was paid for by the university for free. And after half of the group went to do meditation for one day and half went to the spa, then he gave them the standard psychological tests to find out which group was the most relaxed, which actually method worked. Is mindfulness more powerful than going to a spa to relax you and let go, or is, you know, the spa the best? And when he did the survey and collated all the results, it was very, very clear. The people who went to the spa were far more relaxed and happy and healthy. And when he said that, of course, everybody laughed because they had the idea, oh, mindfulness, that is going to work and get rid of all your problems for you. But there's a problem with that type of mindfulness. It's divorced from everything else. And a lot of time it's forced. I have to be mindful. And because you force the mind that way, it usually leads to a lot of tension. Yes, you can observe the mind. Yes, you can observe thoughts coming and going. But with such a degree of tension, your mindfulness is not strong. It is superficial. Literally, you're not really seeing it. And to oppose that type of idea of mindfulness is what most people, when they start meditating, lay people think what mindfulness is. The real mindfulness can be explained with a little simile, which I usually say on every retreat I come here. So those of you who come every year, not every year, but many times a year on these retreats, you've heard this one before, but now I haven't been able to find a better simile to explain what mindfulness is, how it's generated, and what happens when real mindfulness starts to take off. And it's the simile of me walking up the hill on the way to this retreat center, actually to the monastery. Now, you've all come up that hill to get here, and many of you have been up and down that hill so many times. How many of you have walked from the bottom of the hill to the top, or to the top, down to the bottom? Excellent. A few of you have. Well done. It took me 7 years, roughly, to do that walk, living up here. Because why walk when there's always a car to take you up and take you down? So for 7 years, I'd go up and down that hill in a car. This is roughly 7 years. Could have been eight, could have been six, I can't remember. But I do remember the occasion. I'd been off to do something in town, a funeral or something, or do some business. And I came back early, and it was one of these beautiful days like today. And I told the driver, let me out on the bottom of the road. I want to walk up this hill. Now, for a monk, that's a very difficult thing to do, to get to walk. Because people keep stopping and saying, no, get in the car. No, you must walk. No, it's dangerous to walk by yourself. No, you can't do that. It's amazing just how you put your monks in cotton wool so that we can't actually, you know, take a few risks in life and just have some exercise sometimes. So anyway, they let me walk. And now I've been up and down that hill for 7 years, maybe three times a week on average. I thought I knew that hillside. But when I got out of the car and started walking, the hillside looked totally different. And I mean totally different. To the point I was blinking and saying, am I in the right place? What's going on? This isn't the hillside I remember from looking through the window of the car. It was significantly changed. And of course, when those sorts of things happen, you know, you stop and what the heck is going on? Now, am I going crazy or something? What's happening? So I stopped. I stopped walking and just stared at that hillside. And it's no exaggeration, it changed again. It just evolved very quickly. And it became this incredibly beautiful hillside where I saw things which I never noticed before, which I never even expected to see on that hillside. And I saw so much detail, and everything started to become very beautiful. You know what it's like? Sometimes the grass, you see the grass is green, but it's a deep green. There's so many different shades of green, like, you know, a fluorescent green. It's very similar to maybe you've got your glasses, like I wear glasses, and I'm pretty lazy, you know, sometimes I put my fingers on them just after having breakfast, they've got all grease on them, and sometimes somebody comes along and washes them for me. So, oh wow, I can actually see much better now. And that's really what it's like. Everything was like shiny and brilliant and almost like fluorescent, you know, like these yellow and green fluorescent clothing which people work on the roads or have to wear so people can notice them very easily. And everything was so shiny, and the detail there was incredible. Now, even trees a long distance away, you could see their bark, and just the way, it was not just the bark, it's just so much detail, and it's called tessellated bark, you know, with all the little edges, the serrated parts of the bark, you could see it all. And not only could you see so much detail, but it's incredibly beautiful. And I've never seen the hillside look so wonderful. So I was just staring at it, just enjoying it, and just an awe of all the detail which I could see, and the depth of the colours, and how it was just so brilliant and wonderful. And of course, you know, I had to get up to go to the lunch, so I started walking again. But as I walked, you know, when you have big experiences, you have to contemplate them. This is where insight comes from. Powerful experiences, they really sort of change, they really rock you, they challenge you, and you always ask, what the heck is going on? Why? What was occurring there? Why have I seen that hillside so beautiful with so much detail for the first time? So you start reflecting, and insight arises, and one of the frameworks which I use to get insight is science. It's a very good framework to get insight. And so the science part of that, if you haven't heard this story before, was just the nature of sight. Light hits the back of the eye. It causes a chemical reaction on the retina. And those chemicals get transformed into electrical impulses which get processed in the brain. And you see something. But what was happening when I looked through the window of a speeding car, the light did not have enough time to form a full image on the back of my eye before another image came up and dislodged the first, then another, then another, then another. It was just simple chemistry. You didn't have time to see a proper image. So what you saw was just, you know, the main details, like silhouettes. But you never had depth of vision. But when I got out of that car and started walking, the light had more time to form a fuller image. So when I started walking, I saw more detail. Before, you know, the light, a new image came along and dislodged the first. Had more time, so more of the image formed in the back of my eye. And my mind had more time to see it. Not only that, but the colours, it's a chemical reaction. The colours became richer because they had more time to actually to fill out. I still remember at school when we had those old photographs, when you had photographic film instead of these digital cameras. And I always remember, you know, in the science class, developing your own film for the first time. And that was really exciting and memorable. You know, you take a picture and then you put the image on this photographic film and then you put it in this fluid to develop it. It was just like white at first. But then, just as the chemical reaction happened, you can see this image appear from the photographic paper. And little by little, first of all, it was just a few details. And then the colors would become richer and richer and richer until it was fully developed. And that's exactly what happens in the back of the eye. If you don't allow the image to develop long enough, there's no details, the colours are washed out, there's no depth and beauty in it. And that's what's happening in my eye. So when I actually stopped, at that time when I stopped and just stared, when I was still, this magic word, when I was still, only then did all the lights have all the time it needed to form the full image. So I could see all the moss on the little rocks. I could see all the tiny wildflowers poking through the grass. I could see the river at the bottom of the valley just rushing over the rocks. You saw so much because you were still, and the image had all the time it needed to form. Not only that, the colors were very deep and very rich. It was beautiful. And that's all it was. The power of stillness to allow your senses enough time to see what's really out there. And of course, from that experience, it explains so much about meditation and about life in general. Why is it that so many people make the same mistakes over and over again? Why is it there is something called stupidity which we all share? Why don't we learn? One of the reasons is we live our life as if in a speeding car looking out the window. And we think we know the person we live with. We think we know the monks in front of us and the nuns. We think we know the street in which we live and the life in which we travel. But you don't, that's the point. You're looking through the window of a person who's moving too fast. The images of life don't fully form. There's no depth, there's no detail. And more importantly, strangely, this is an important part of mindfulness. There's no happiness. There's no depth, there's no beauty. It's one of the reasons why there is an increase of depression in our modern world. The increase in depression is proportional to the speed with which we live our lives. The faster we go, the more washed out are the colors, the tastes, the beauty in life. Our senses are moving too fast to really appreciate anything. So life has no joy, no depth, no beauty. It's there, but we're too fast. Another image, another experience comes too soon after the last one, so nothing fully forms. Life is washed out. Pastel, grey. It's one of the great causes of modern-day depression. And you can know that disease is increasing as the speed of our societies gets faster. Now you know why. So, what's that to do with mindfulness? What's it to do with mindfulness? You can see that as I went slower, I saw more. My mindfulness increased. The awareness got stronger. And from experiences like that, and also experiences in meditation, I sort of developed this idea of quantifying mindfulness. It's not you're mindful or you're not mindful. It's not black and white. It's not some binary code, mindful, not mindful. There are so many different levels of mindfulness. So I coined the words power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. And that's an important idea to understand when we know how mindfulness works in meditation, and how it gets insight, and especially insight which enlightens you. We have ordinary mindfulness which thinks it can see. Like the mindfulness of myself looking through the window of a speeding car. I thought I knew that hill. I thought I understood the place in which I lived. And it was a shock to see and understand how little I had perceived and how much I had missed. It's a trouble with mindfulness, ordinary mindfulness. You think you can see. You think you know. You assume that, yes, thought coming in, thought going out, perception, emotion. You assume that you know, but you're missing too much. Why? Because you're going too fast. The trick of mindfulness is to slow down and become still. The slower you go, the more awake you become. The stronger the mindfulness, the more power it has. Very much like you first get up in the morning, there's only a few lights on the corridors. And that's actually to save electricity. You don't need to have this place illuminated like it's, you know, some shopping mall. Enough light is in the corridors so you can find your way to this hall in the early morning. But it's still dark. And in the early morning, before we turn the lights up for the chanting, it's still dark. You can't see too much because you don't need to when it's seeing the place where you have to sit and the people in this hall. But as the morning comes and the light starts to come through those windows, the whole place brightens up. You can start to see colours and shapes and people. And as the morning progresses until noon, the place gets brighter and brighter. And as it gets brighter and brighter, you can see which man hasn't shaved this morning. You can't see that in the early morning because it's dark. But as it gets lighter and lighter, that's where you start to see more details. That's also the reason why, and I've mentioned this before, if you're dating someone, if you want romance, always go to a dark place. Candlelit restaurant, out in the moonlight, in a nightclub. Nightclubs are dark. That's why you can't see all those details which will turn you off from that girl or that boy. You can't see her spots. Yeah, you can't see his grey hair. You don't want to, do you? That's why we go out in the dark. So, in the brightness, you see more. And it gets very powerful. And that's what mindfulness is. It's like turning up the power of the mind. Like turning up the dimmer lights. So it gets brighter and brighter and brighter and you can see more. Now, a lot of time people don't want to be mindful because, you know, they're afraid of what they may see. That's why you don't want to go out with your girlfriend in the middle of the day and really have a look at her and see all the pimples and other stuff. Because, you know, we want to live in the fantasy of romance. But if you're going to be committed to insight, if you really want to see what's out there, you've got to be courageous. You've got to be prepared to see what you don't like seeing. What challenges you to the core. What really upsets you. What shocks you. What brings up the most existential fear. I don't exist. And that is the sort of stuff which you've got to see if you're going to have the insight which gets enlightened. For that, you need incredibly powerful mindfulness. Not the ordinary mindfulness you have now, but really strong mindfulness. And you've already started to experience some of that, even on this retreat. Because I emphasize stillness, letting things go, letting things be, you will actually discover the more still you are, the more awake you are, the more powerful is your mind. And even, I don't mind dobbing in my sensitivity. He was telling me he was getting some good meditation yesterday. And last night he couldn't sleep very well. He could hardly sleep. Exactly. That's what happens. When you start getting still, you get so much energy coming up. You don't need to sleep. You start getting powerful mindfulness. This happened to me many times when I used to do retreats. And the first time this happened, I told this story in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, when I started explaining this concept of power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. The very first retreat I went on, and I had lots of good fortune, I really got into some deep meditation. Actually, the first teacher I had is amazing, my good karma. I remember him saying, "I'm teaching you this meditation so you can get into first jhana." And there's hardly anybody teaching jhana in those days. That was 1969. And I had to come across a teacher who came up to Cambridge University to teach jhana from the very earliest times. That's incredibly good fortune. But on the first retreat I did with this fellow, I got into some really nice meditation. But on that retreat, it was in boarding houses. student boarding houses. This was done in the vacation, so we could hire, three boarding houses for the retreatants. There was about 40 of us. And we were allowed every morning out of the boarding house just for 1 hour, these strict retreats in those days, for exercise, for a walk before breakfast. And remember, I was been at Cambridge and I knew the area. And I knew very close by, maybe 5 minutes walk, was the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, the back entrance. So, of course, the first day, if you're going to go for a walk, have a walk in the beautiful botanical gardens. So I went there to have a walk, supposedly for exercise. But what happened to me was when I got to the entrance, at the entrance to the botanical gardens, there was a clump of bamboo. And when I got in, I saw this bamboo, and my goodness, it was so beautiful. Now, bamboo is a very beautiful plant, which is one of the reasons when you see Chinese watercolors, you always see bamboo. And some of those great masters, I remember going to Hong Kong 2 years ago, one and a half years ago, I went there last February. About a year and a half ago, they took me around. I always have to do one day sort of seeing the city in which I'm giving talks, and said, "What do you want to do?" And I just got bored out of my skull. And there was an art exhibition, in the museum. And I said, "Well, this is Hong Kong. This will be some really good Chinese watercolors." And so they took me in there, and I really enjoyed that because that was something I don't want to see. Sort of, the ferry or the big buildings, that's not what a monk likes seeing, but the watercolors of nature with monks, and many of them were actually painted by monks. That really interested me, and it had incredibly beautiful, these very, very long watercolors with mountains and waterfalls and little huts where monks used to stay, and always the bamboo. That's why it gets in many watercolors, because it's a very beautiful plant. It's sensuous just the way it bends. And just the whole arc of that bamboo is just delightful to see. And just the way it tapers, just like the leaves. It's a very sensuous plant, is the bamboo. When I saw this plant, a few clumps of bamboo at the entrance, it was incredibly beautiful. In the morning, the light of dawn. And as a light breeze, it was just swaying, like dancing, like a ballet. And I was so entranced by it, I couldn't take my eyes off that clump of bamboo. And I stood there staring. And I had enough self-possession, awareness of my surroundings, to think, if somebody sees me like this, they're going to call the ambulance and take me away. They think I'm one of these students taking drugs or having a psychotic episode. Because, who actually stands for 10 minutes perfectly still staring at a bamboo tree? Only crazy people or meditators. So, what I did, I noticed there was a bench close by. I sat on that bench so that I could stare at that bamboo without anybody thinking I was crazy. And it was a great tug of war to pull myself away from that beautiful clump of bamboo to go to breakfast. But I did that because I said, tomorrow I'll come back again. For 8 of the 9 days, the other day I had a walk by the river because I really needed some exercise. And I purposely avoided that clump of bamboo that one day. But 8 of the 9 days on that retreat, I went to that bench, sat down and just stared. Now, in awe at this incredibly beautiful clump of bamboo. Then the retreat ended. Then you were back to your studies and partying and all the stuff you do as a student. But I had a free afternoon. And I thought, what to do? I'm going to go back and look at my beautiful clump of bamboo. I haven't seen it for a couple of weeks. So I got on my bicycle, as I did in Cambridge, and I weaved through the traffic, got to the entrance of the Botanical Gardens, got off with great excitement. I'm going to see this beautiful clump of bamboo. And when I saw it, it was one of the biggest downers of my life. It was so disappointing. Because this clump of bamboo, it was dry. It was desiccated. It was just dusty. Because you shouldn't grow bamboo in England. The climate's not right. It doesn't thrive. And it was just the most insipid, dirty, weak, ugly clump of bamboo I could ever imagine. And it was again such a shock to me. I thought, where's my beautiful clump of bamboo gone? What's happened? Who's taken it away? And again, those experiences give you insight. You contemplate. It's the same clump of bamboo. What's happened is my mind has changed. I've lost my mindfulness. The power of mindfulness is gone. Now I just have the ordinary mindfulness like everyone else has. They look at that clump of bamboo and it's just ordinary. In fact, it's less than ordinary. It shouldn't be there. It's the wrong plant in the wrong climate. But when my mind had opened up with lots of stillness and lots of power, that tree looked incredibly beautiful. Because my mind was beautiful. It had power. Superpower. So it could stay with that clump of bamboo and just stare at it for hour after hour after hour. Totally delighted, totally satisfied, seeing things which I couldn't see anymore. That's a sign of power, mindfulness, and superpower mindfulness. That's the type of mindfulness I want you to develop. The other thing which occurred to me on that retreat, which bears mentioning, was this was a retreat in boarding houses in England in 1969, or 70, sorry. Many of you know the reputation of the British, especially 40 years ago. Yes, they were a very innovative society, but the one part of their culture which they had not developed, fortunately they've developed that since, where they lagged behind the rest of Europe in culture was in their cuisine. The food was well known in that time of being disgusting. We used to have 3-course meals usually. Meat and 2 veg, and it all tasted the same. No matter what vegetable, no matter what meat. Which is why you had to develop all these sauces to give it some sort of taste. Because all the vegetables were boiled to hell until there was no taste left in them. And I remember that. I got used to that. That's why I used to have lots of gravy and salt and pepper to make it tasty. But of all the cooks in the whole of that country, yeah, there were some good ones. But the bottom of the pile, because they weren't paid very much, were those employed to cook for poor students. Though I knew the reputation of boarding house food, now it was down the bottom of the ladder of a very, very low league. And I'd even contemplated taking sandwiches to that retreat, in case I couldn't stand the food. But to my surprise, my pleasant surprise, the food was delicious. I really enjoyed it. And I thought at the time it was because, again, my good karma, I've had lots of good karma in my life, maybe the only decent cook in all the boarding houses in all that country was the one who was cooking for me. But that was not the case. Afterwards I realized that was just the ordinary cook like anyone else. Again, what had happened, my mindfulness has increased. I was so super mindful because of stillness. Not because of force, because of stillness. But whatever flavor was left after all that boiling, I could taste. I could pick it up. Because my mind was so sensitive. Even the fragment, the small, tiny fraction of flavor left, I could enjoy. And I know that from many, many times. When I come on retreat, when I do more meditation than I do at the monastery, or if I do my own personal retreat. You know, when I do personal retreats over in Bodhinyana, one of the monks puts food in my bowl, so I don't choose. They just put food in the bowl and they bring it to me. I couldn't work out, why is it when I choose food for myself, compared with when other people put food in my bowl, when other people do it for me, it's more delicious. And I thought, I must be crazy. Why don't I choose the food which is delicious? When other people put it in there, and they don't know really what I like, but when they put it in there, it's more delicious, more tasty. What's going on? And of course, it's nothing to do with the food. When I'm on retreat, my mindfulness goes up many notches. So whatever I eat is more tasty. The same on this retreat. Is the food delicious on this retreat? It's nothing to do with the cooks. It's everything to do with you. Your mindfulness is increasing. And the more you develop your stillness, the more delicious the food is. I've got some very good meditation. I get into very, very powerful states. That's why my mindfulness is so great, that some of the food I eat is so delicious, is one of the reasons I put on weight. You get rid of, oh, this is delicious. Wow, you know, this carrot. Wow, this is the most delicious carrot. I have to tap another one. No, but it's true, isn't it? You've noticed the food in this retreat gets more and more delicious as the days go by, simply because your stillness, your mindfulness is increasing. So what happens, you don't force mindfulness. You don't make it happen. You don't say, I must be mindful. Come on, watch it. Watch what you're doing. Come on, what's thoughts coming in the mind? Come on, come on. Yes, you can be aware, but it has no depth to it, no power. It's one of also the reasons why on those retreats no one smiles. There's no happiness, there's no beauty, there's no joy. That's a great sign it's not superpower mindfulness. Through stillness, making the mind very peaceful, the energy of the mind increases. More energy goes into knowing rather than doing. That's what makes it powerful mindfulness. I've mentioned this in brief earlier, just in more detail now. There are two halves to the mind. It's one way of looking at the mind. The active mind and the passive mind. The active mind you can recognize, which thinks, which plans, which argues, which makes decisions, which decides what to do next, which complains. All of that, even that which notes, that's an active mind. If you suppress that, you stop it. Don't do anything. Let things be. Be compassionate, which is opening the door of your heart to whoever's doing what, which means you don't do anything. You're gentle. These are all words telling you to be still, not to want, not to do. If you can manage that, you are suppressing the doer, the active mind. And by blocking that, the energy of the mind, this natural source of energy, instead of being wasted in thinking, acting, doing, planning, complaining, taking notes, instead, it all goes into knowing, to awareness, to mindfulness. This is where the energy comes from, which powers your mindfulness. Literally, the more you do, the less mindful you are. The more you're still, the more mindful you are, the more power there is in the knowing. That's basically how it works. When I understood that, I understood why it was when I stopped walking, I could see more. Why that when I did lots of meditation, I could experience incredibly beautiful beauty in the bamboo, which didn't really deserve to be called beautiful. Why when I looked at the food, I could enjoy it and smile. The corollary to mindfulness, which I never expected, but which is really important for you to understand. The more mindful you are, it's not the more you see, which is true, not the more you understand, but the more beautiful everything starts to look. You get happiness. The more mindful, the more happy. That's something which I never expected. And I thought, where in the suttas did it say this? Where did the Buddha say this? And of course, when you look for it, you can find it. Where you find that, if anyone wants to look at this, because sometimes there's many people talking about many things, so usually go back to the final authority, the Buddha suttas. One of the suttas there is the Dhammacetya Sutta. It's in one other sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It literally means like monuments to the Dhamma. And In that sutta, there's a story of one of the Buddha's chief disciples, lay disciples, who was King Pasadena, of the most powerful kingdom in that area called Kosala. And the monastery where the Buddha spent most of his time, in the Jetavana, the Jeta Grove Monastery, was just outside the capital of Kosala, Sarvati. So for about 25 rains retreat, the king had the Buddha just within walking distance. And so would often visit the Buddha, and the Buddha would visit the king and teach him all sorts of things. The king was a really, really close disciple of the Buddha. But one of these disciple-teacher relationships where it was not just as a teacher, this king actually loved the Buddha. Now, literally, you know, he's like my father, and you're just so grateful to all the kindness and the compassion and the teachings which the Buddha gave over the years. So one day, you know, when the king had finished his business, you know, I can't see the Buddha. So he walked over to the Jetavana monastery and asked the monks, where's the Buddha? Is he in? You know, even the Buddha used to travel overseas, but I travel in aircraft. You know, the Buddha used to fly in his own speed. But so he asked him, is the Buddha in? I said, yeah, he's in his hut. He's probably meditating. But, you know, you're the king. If you knock on the door and say it's the king here, you know, he'll probably answer. And I don't think I would do that. If I'm in my cave and say, Julie Gillard, the Prime Minister of Australia, not, no, thank you. Come back later on when I'm free. But the Buddha was more compassionate than I was. So he let the king in. And so he let the king in. And the king just got and grabbed onto the Buddha's feet and started kissing them. And this was the king. The Buddha said, what the heck are you doing? And the king said, look, he's a very nice character which is drawn in the suttas, but a simple guy with a lot of power, but, you know, had a really big heart, you know, a very like simple but very kind guy. And he just said, just I love you, you know, you just give me so much joy in my life, you know, just I love you better than my queens. I said, okay, off you go. And then the king was saying, in all the years I've been here, I just love coming to this monastery. This is the part the sutta which I'm pointing out. And the Buddha said, why do you love coming to this monastery? And that's where the king said, because when I come into this monastery, all the monks are happy and smiling. And it's one of the few places where it describes what it was like to go into a monastery in the time of the Buddha. What it appeared like. So I love going here because all the monks are happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yeah, that's what you'd expect when the monks are meditating and developing insight, to see them happy and smiling. Now that is something you should always keep in mind. If you go into any monastery, any temple, and the monks, the nuns, the teachers aren't happy and smiling, that means their meditation's not working. I say that with authority, with a lot of care as well, because sometimes people will criticize. What do you mean? We're not supposed to smile. This is what the Buddha said. And this is the nature. The more still you are, the more mindful, the more that this goes up. That is the indicator of your meditation. The more this goes up, the more you're getting into deep meditation. Now that's really true, because sometimes when people come on interviews, especially the monks, and they come and say, oh, I saw this, I saw that, I saw, you know, quite frankly, I don't pay much attention to what you say. But I look at your body language, especially the smile and the emotional content of your experience, and that is a much better indicator to me of, you know, what you've been experiencing. Because, you know, we can add all sorts of ideas and concepts onto our experiences. A lot of times we're saying what we want the teacher to hear, you know, or what we would like to have achieved. We do that, you know, without... it's nature to exaggerate and elaborate and see the most positive side of our experiences. But the emotional side you can't lie about, you can't deceive yourself about. And that is what really tells me, yeah, this person, yeah, she's had a big experience. because the happiness gets huge. Now this is what occurs. Stillness, happiness, mindfulness. The three increase. And that's what you'll experience. The more still you are, the more aware you are. And the happier you are. So, when you experience this, all this idea of forcing mindfulness and making yourself mindful, it just doesn't make any sense at all. And the idea that you have to have a horizontal mouth to be a real practitioner. And you think that's mindfulness. That's not mindfulness at all. And I don't have to teach you this. You'll experience that. I've given you many sort of indications. There'll be times on this retreat you'll have a really nice meditation, so still, so peaceful, and you come out with a big smile on your face, which you can't fake, it's natural, you're so happy. And you go outside, you see the first plant in the box, a little flower. Wow, that's incredibly beautiful. And you see just even the brick on the wall. Wow, have you seen that brick? And this is just what happens. And what happened to you? That is a sign that what I'm saying is just not made up. This is not theory. This is not just repeating what your teachers said. This is what happens. And you really wake up. You can't sleep. You don't want to sleep. You don't need to sleep. Sloth and torpor is just way gone. You're alert. You're happy. You're engaged. All come from this stillness. Now, one thing to be careful of, sometimes you get too bubbly and start, you know, dancing to the breakfast. Please restrain yourself a little bit, please. But people have done that. They told me, they said, can I dance, please? And I feel so much happiness and joy. Yeah, your mindfulness is incredibly strong, but always remember a bit of restraint. Now that is a type of mindfulness. You know these different types of mindfulness when you've experienced them. You just know how hopeless it is to try and get enlightened with ordinary mindfulness. It's just not powerful enough. It's just so weak. Similarly, it's like trying to dig a hole for the septic tank with a spoon. A little spoon, you're digging and digging. It'll take you all day, all week, all year to dig a hole. That's ordinary mindfulness. When you've got superpower mindfulness, you've got one of these big backhoes, especially like they have in the north of Western Australia in the mines. Huge things, just one scoop, and there's a huge hole there. It's just so powerful. And that's what superpower mindfulness is like. Incredibly strong. So that's the type of mindfulness which you can put on an object and you can really penetrate right into it. If you can spend an hour looking at an ordinary clump of bamboo, how much can you spend just looking at this body in awe of what's going on in there? How long can you just spend just on this mind in total wow of what this mind is? Stay long enough to really understand it. Those are the types of mindfulness which creates a deep insight. One of the other reasons it creates deep insights, because again, many of these insights, as I will probably explain later on, they shock you. They turn you around. I will never forget one of the previous presidents of the Buddhist Fellowship a long time ago. Those from Singapore will probably understand who I'm talking about. When I first went over there, I gave lots of talks about two bad bricks in the wall, open the door of your heart, the Emperor's Three Questions, all these nice, feel-good similes, which people thought, oh, that's really nice. But then one day he said, look, can't we have a really deep talk on on Buddhism? None of this superficial. Get really to the heart of it, Give me a really deep talk on anatta, non-self. So I agree. So I gave him this talk on anatta, on non-self, really going for it, as he asked for. And the following morning, he picked me up to take me to breakfast and complained, said, please never do that again. He said, I couldn't sleep all night. I was so terrified. I said, really, you were terrified? Yeah, I couldn't sleep. He said, well, that must have been a good talk. Because some of these things actually really frighten you. I know that's in the suttas as well. The Buddha said that sometimes he gives a talk on non-self even to the monks, and the monks get afraid and terrified. Because I'm challenging the most deepest of your attachments, the one which you have depended upon and stood on. Literally, it's like taking the rug from under your very meaning of existence. These are powerful things which you are doing here. And there will come a time when it's not fear, it's terror. To be able to do that, you need power and joy. That gives you the courage. The word for energy or effort in Pali is called virya. Sometimes people think that means you've got to force the mind. That's virya. No. The word virya, I'm going into some nice, interesting parts of the Dhamma. I noticed when I started learning Pali that that is associated with the word vira. Vira is the noun, virya is the adjective which comes from that noun. And vira means the hero. For those of you who have a little understanding of Buddhist history, one of the contemporaries of the Buddha was called Mahavira, the leader of the Jains. Literally meant the great hero. That's what vira means, a hero. So virya is the stuff of heroes. Now remember, that particular culture was a farming and military culture. And that's where they got many of their metaphors from either farming or from military things. So even the Buddha called himself the king of the Dhamma, and Sariputta was the general, militaristic. But that was the metaphors in that time. But the metaphor of the hero in the army was someone who go into battle willing to give their life, to abandon everything for the cause. And that is the sort of virya, the energy, which the Buddha's talking about in the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's not just effort, it's a sacrifice. The willing to abandon everything for the cause of truth and freedom, no matter how scary it is. Imagine going into battle, how scary that would be. And all these huge men are coming towards you with their axes and swords, shouting and screaming, wanting to cut your heads and arms off. That's pretty scary. I know if that was me, I'd run in the other direction. But the hero just runs, just willing to sacrifice everything, even their life. Now that's the type of energy if you want to become enlightened. The ability to be so aware and so powerful, it doesn't matter what you find, what you have to abandon for truth, for freedom, enlightenment, you're willing to do that. Now you understand why this is an amazing thing you're doing. And the only way you can have that type of courage is to have the power of superpower mindfulness. You feel you can do anything after good meditation. You can face anything, and things which would scare you don't scare you anymore. I remember even my preceptor, Somdet Gyo, he's now the acting Sangharaja of Thailand. One of the stories he told me, some people think he's just an administrative monk, but when he was young, he would practice meditation, and he said in the south of Thailand, I think it must have been on the place where he lived, which was Koh Samui, that's where he grew up. And I remember him telling me that he was meditating one day, and he got into a very nice meditation, and when he woke up, there was a snake on his lap. He got out of his meditation, there was a snake there. And he knew, because you have to know growing up in that part of Thailand which snakes were dangerous and which were venomous. That was one of the very venomous ones. He said he had absolutely no fear at all. He said it was so peaceful to see the snake on his lap. He just waited for the snake to go. Only afterwards he thought, wow, that was really weird. But I had absolutely no fear when I had one of the most venomous snakes on my lap. He said that's one of the things which happen when you meditate. You get into fearless states. Afterwards, when you come back in, But when you're right there, it's just a snake. So what? And that's what mindfulness does to you as well. It takes away fear. So that also can sort of understand as a sign. Very mindful, no fear, lots of power, lots of energy. Now, before I finish off, that was describing what mindfulness is and how it comes, the more still, the more calm, the more power. And why you need that power to get deep meditation. But there's another part of mindfulness which I wanted to bring up before it's too late, a practical part of mindfulness for each one of you. Again, something which I developed because I saw this happening and thought, wow, this is a very interesting effect. I saw that many times when I got into deep states of meditation and I didn't know what to do next, and basically I got lost and had the next idea, so you're getting a bit lost. A solution came to me, which worked, and so you managed to get deeper in your meditation. And after I said, wow, that was very innovative, you know, the way I did that. And then I noticed, hang on, I remember Ajahn Chah telling me that. And that was years ago. What I actually discovered, and what each one of you discover, that some of the teachings which I give here, or which other great monks or nuns give you, sometimes you don't even remember them. So you think. You don't need to note them down. Because the deeper teachings, the ones which work on the very refined states of meditation, they are programmed into you. They were programmed into me by Ajahn Chah, just words he said, which stayed in my mind. And when they were needed, in the deep states of meditation, they were right there for me. So many of the things which I say to you now, you may not even register them. You may think that, you know, totally forget them. But there will be times in your meditation, especially when you get very deep, you come across a difficulty or blockage, and you will overcome that blockage. And if you reflect afterwards, it's something which you heard me say maybe years earlier. It's what I call programming your mindfulness. Similar to the way we have all these antivirus programs you put in your computer. And they only kick in when they're needed. When somebody tries to hack in your computer as a Trojan or something, then the viruses catch them. You don't know, you may put the antivirus in for, you know, months before, but it's there waiting for the time when it's needed. And that's what programming mindfulness means. Listening to good teachings, when it's necessary, your mind will remember them. Not verbally, subverbally, and you make the right non-movement to go deep into meditation. But you can also do that yourself as well. Many times people say they have this problem in meditation, that problem in meditation, what should I do? Look, say if it's a nimitta and you can't settle the nimitta down. If in the time when you have a nimitta you try and settle it down, it won't work. If you don't do anything, it won't work. You're in this terrible bind. If I do something, it'll go wrong. If I don't do something, it's going wrong. What the heck should I do? And the solution is this programming mindfulness, which you can use in other times of your life as well. How it works? The beginning of your meditation. And it doesn't matter if you disturb your mind. You put the instructions in. When I get to the nimitta stage, I'll just let it be. When I get to the nimitta stage, I'll just let it be. When I get to the nimitta stage, I'll just let it be. Now, don't you do that. You make up your own words. Your own instructions to suit the problem you have in that time of meditation. And just make it simple. Just one instruction. Not A, B, C, D, E. That doesn't work. Too complex. One simple instruction which makes sense, which you can understand. Repeat it 3 times, paying as much attention as you can to what you're saying. And then forget about it. It's incredible how that works. That's really helped my meditation so much. When there's a, you know, meditate, same thing happens 2 or 3 times. Next meditation, okay. When that happens, this is the solution, this is what I'll do. And then you get to that stage in meditation, and it kicks in. Subverbal, you don't do anything. It's just the mind, it's already been programmed. It says, this is what you should do now. And you just do it, and you get into nice meditation. Program of mindfulness. If you don't believe that, you can do a little experiment tonight. If you haven't done this already, it's well worthwhile doing. Decide what time you're going to get up tomorrow morning. 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Apparently breakfast is now 6:45, 6:44. Whatever time you want to wake up in the morning. Set your alarm clock to say 6:46. So you don't need to be worried. You're going to wake up. And then, when you go to bed, settle yourself into bed, make yourself nice and comfortable, and then tell yourself, I will wake up at 6:44. I will wake up at 6:44. I will wake up at 6:44. Forget about it and go to sleep. You'll be amazed that you'll be sleeping and you'll suddenly wake up. What time is it? You look at the clock, usually 1 minute either side of 6:44. It's incredible how accurate. I said 6:44, instead of 6:30, 6:45, 6:43 and a half if you want. It's incredible how precise this brain is. Usually a minute either side. And when you do that a few times, it shocks you. How did I know that? You don't have to keep thinking, oh, is it 6:43 and a half yet? And you look, oh no, it's only 6 o'clock. No, it just happens. Quite naturally, you just wake up, open your eyes, and there it is. You've programmed your mind. It has its own internal clock, as most biologists know, and you just use that. And this memory, especially when you program the mind, is very powerful. You can even use that if you're someone, like people asked last night, I always get angry. Especially your partner. So you can program yourself before you see your partner. I will not say a bad word to my partner. I will not say a bad word to my partner. I will not say a bad word to my partner. That's it. It's as simple as that. And then when you see them, and they do something stupid, and yet the same habit will come in. You stupid husband. But something kicks in. You stop. The program works. It stops you. It's amazing how powerful that is. Give it a try. Play with it. That's called programming mindfulness. And you can use that to solve so many problems in meditation. Your mindfulness will change the way you react. So that is a talk, because I've gone over time already, the talk on mindfulness, especially power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness, and the happiness which comes the more powerful your mindfulness is, and the depth of perception of any sense, especially the mind. At last you can see, you can know. You think you know, just like I think I knew this hillside. Like I thought I knew a clump of bamboo. But when you're still, the mindfulness gets powerful. Wow, how did I miss all of that? So, be calm, be still. Happiness and mindfulness just grow. And then you know what mindfulness is. So that's the talk today on mindfulness. Powerful mindfulness. Superpower mindfulness. And the super happiness and insights which come. Sadhu. 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 Excellent.